Good morning. Our first case today is United States against Anderson. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Eugene Fidel for Specialist Brian Anderson. With me at the council table is Lieutenant Colonel Miller. In the gallery is Mr. Freitas, who is also counsel on the case, as is Colonel Teletoche. As I begin, let me say that I personally appreciated the rescheduling of the argument. I will mention that Captain Barry was, in fact, buried yesterday in an extremely moving full-dress ceremony. The other preliminary is that I'd like to mention two things that inevitably jump out when you review your briefs. In our reply brief at page 8, we mistakenly referred to Judge Boudreau in the masculine gender. We got her gender right later in the brief, and I'm embarrassed that we didn't get it right the first time. In addition, on page 11, footnote 5 of our reply brief, we inadvertently omitted the word forensic, which is a pertinent modifier in this case.
Thank you, counsel.
In defense, I'm not here to defend what happened at the trial in this case or in connection with the what I would say is the principal issue that we're here to discuss. But I will mention that this case was tried before this court decided the Warner case. I am confident, or I would like to be confident, that the matter would have been handled differently had Warner come down at the time of the pivotal events in the case. There are many respects in which the military justice system has become assimilated to the civilian criminal justice system, but there remain a number in which that's not, number of respects in which that's not true. Control over the defense's selection of experts is a matter that I think is a difference between the military and the civilian federal criminal justice systems. And our view is that public confidence in the administration of justice has some implications in this part of the forest. First, and I can think of three respects in which that's the case. First is the reviewing courts ought to apply, to use a phrase that the D.C. Circuit has used from time to time, a hard look when scrutinizing such questions. The second is, given the government's selection of the defense's expert, it would seem to me that a kind of estoppel functions. You could put it different ways. We used a more colorful folkloric term in our brief. But there's a kind of estoppel. It simply doesn't lie in the mouth of the government to impugn the qualifications of an expert that it is itself responsible for here. Now, it is a fact that the expert on which the defense relied was named in the government's, in the defense's own papers, but the source for that was the indication by the government that that was the that was the witness the government would provide. In other words, the path, you can track that back to a government decision, even though it flows through defense-initiated paperwork.
Counsel, when the motion is made to the military judge, does the military judge give any deference to the role of the trial counsel or the convening authority in the process, or does the military judge make a de novo decision as to the availability of a particular expert?
If your question, Chief Judge Efron, is a normative one, I would say the military judge should afford no deference. This is.
And what happened in this case? Did the military judge give any deference to the selection by the government, or did the military judge look at the case fresh?
No, I don't think the military judge looked at the case fresh.
What would you point to in the record as the basis for saying the military judge didn't give a fresh look to this issue?
Because no consideration was given, as far as I recall the record, no consideration was given to whether some alternative individual beyond the one that was effectively put forward by the government as the take-it-or-leave-it expert. And if the military judge were performing his function, or, excuse me, there I go again, her function, de novo, then there would have been I think, quite different kind of colloquy. There would have been a different dynamic, in fact, in the communication. You don't get that feeling. Now,
are you quarreling with the military judge's initial denial of the expert that was requested, or are you just accepting that as that's what happened, and your argument goes on from there as to the second expert or the
Judge Irvin, the latter? I think it would be different, had no expert, if nobody ever concluded that the defense needed an expert here, that would be a different case.
And with respect to the second expert, since that apparently is what you're focusing on, is your quarrel with the fact that he was not a forensic psychiatrist, or is your quarrel with the fact that the government in rebuttal put on a forensic psychiatrist?
It's both of those. He wasn't a forensic anything, Judge Ryan.
I understand it. That's why I asked, what is your quarrel? What is it precisely that you are think is wrong with what happened?
What we think is wrong here is that at the end of the day, there was a disparity.
Okay, and so you're saying the disparity between Colonel Malone, the forensic psychiatrist that the government put on, and the defense psychologist and psychiatrist that they put on.
That's correct.
If that's the case, what specifically did Colonel Malone say during his limited testimony that either hurt the defense case or helped the government case?
Your Honor, I can't give you the kind of response that I would like to be able to give you because to this moment, we have not had the assistance of a forensic psychiatrist. My degree is an LLB. That's my highest degree earned or otherwise. I don't have an MD. I don't have a PhD. And I think that for us to be able to give the kind of rigorous response that your question invites would require us to have the kind of expertise at our table.
Well, you don't disagree that Colonel Malone agreed that the diagnoses made by the two defense experts were reasonable.
Yes, he did say that. Yes,
and you don't suggest that the government expert opined as to his own diagnosis, correct?
Yes, of course.
And the government expert didn't say a word as to whether the accused could or could not have formed the requisite intent, did he?
That's correct also, Judge Ryan. The difficulty, though, is it's not simply a question of what Dr. Malone testified to. It's the resource that Dr. Malone constituted for the prosecution, a resource that we were denied. And you can't, I can't speculate about how this would have unfolded had we had a Dr. Malone available to the defense. I think as I read the Warner case, I think the court, and this in fact was the third point that I wanted to mention it. I think the court has to be deeply skeptical because of the government's authority and control over.
What could Dr. Malone have provided that Dr. Norris could not provide?
Credibility and the ability to speak with clout and punch.
And so it's It's based on their personal attributes on the witness stand?
No, it's not simply that. It's bringing to bear the kind of rigorous scientific thinking that would likely be...
But what Judge Ryan, I think, is trying to get at, and what I'm trying to get at, is concrete examples. Dr. Malone was an expert in DNA analysis. Dr. Norris wasn't, rather than just Dr. Malone's better. Why is he better?
We can't fully answer that, Judge Baker, because we don't know what the interaction was between, necessarily, the interaction was between Dr. Malone and the trial counsels.
Okay.
In framing their case and framing their strategy. It's an unknown to us.
So it's all based on speculation that somehow Malone would have been better, but you don't know unless he was there.
Who do we have that conversation with?
I think that we understand your argument with respect to the second issue. Would you mind talking with respect to the first specified issue, if you would, as to you make an argument that Article 104 preempts an Article 134 charge with respect to the same underlying behavior. Could you please talk about that issue and specifically explain how we would look to congressional intent to suggest that by enacting Article 104, they intended that to cover the field with respect to this sort of offense?
Right. Yes, I will, but I hope you permit me to say one more fragment before I leave point two.
It's your time.
I'm not forgetting your question. It was only to hope that the court would take a careful look at the question of what the convening authority thought he was doing when he appointed the when he approved the defense expert. There are representations that both the staff judge advocate and the convening authority actually understood that the defense expert was not a forensic psychologist, but in fact the paperwork says, I'm approving this forensic psychologist. So that's the one thing I wanted to make sure I got out.
I have one follow-up on that. Had the government then utilized, in this case, a psychologist in rebuttal, rather than a forensic psychiatrist or even a forensic psychologist, my impression is you wouldn't be here on that issue.
No, I'd be here, but my argument would, let's say, be somewhat less, it would be a somewhat less strong argument.
But it seems to me the only distinction you're making is that the individual for the government was a forensic psychiatrist, and that's the friend. And without that, this argument would seem to dissipate.
I don't think it dissipates to the point that there wouldn't be sufficient daylight for the court to be able to, and I think be required to conclude that the required equality of arms under Article 46 had not been achieved. I'm invading my own time, but let's do it because Judge Ryan did have a question. Judge Ryan, we addressed this to some extent. Neither side has been able to point to any legislative history. I don't know of any legislative history that bears on the preemption question that you raised. We're cast back effectively on the terms of the statute. The government's contention was, well, look, it's obviously not preempted. After all, we've seen this before. And I think that if you examine the cases that the government relies on, they don't support the government's contention that, you know, that there's anything in the statute necessarily, much less anything in the legislative history that supports their view. I don't know of a way to analyze the preemption issue where, as here, you don't have legislative history other than looking at the statutes themselves.
Well, I mean, is the enactment of a specific statute in itself some evidence of congressional
intent? Absolutely.
I mean,
it's the best evidence.
I mean, can you distinguish this case from the case, and I don't remember if it was Kick or Mays or whatever it was, where they found that the murder statute, for example, did not preempt a manslaughter offense under Article 134. And the rationale there was that manslaughter had previously been an LIO of murder.
Right. I would say the drafters of the code were quite aware of the rich body of substantive criminal law when they advised Congress. I don't have any difficulty seeing that there would not be preemption as between murder and manslaughter. Anybody who studied criminal law in this country or the mother country over the last 400 years would not have had any problem with that. However, where you have an offense such as the one that we're talking about, that is a creature of statute only. It's, I believe, fairly read, broad enough to cover the field, and I think to cause Article 134 to do additional duty is the kind of thing, frankly, that can give military justice a bad name. It looks like Article 134 is being used as the ultimate catch-all. If we don't get you under one, we'll get you under the other. And what really drives public opinion or public confidence in the administration of justice, and that nobody really knows. It's a sort of construct that we use as a surrogate for other kinds of values. But there is a sense in which Congress knew how to deal with this. It dealt with it. And frankly, I don't know how much more analytical an answer anyone could give to your question. That's sort of I think that's the best I can do. It's not a particularly satisfactory answer, but I think if you go into this thinking, well, Article 134 is infinitely flexible, I think that might that carry the day? I don't know, but I don't think it's a good thing. And where you have Congress that has passed legislation that is sufficiently potent to sweep in the gist of the conduct here, instead of providing the government five different bites at the apple, I don't think the court should be struggling to support the fifth of those five.
Counsel, you'll have a further opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Captain Stephanie Cooper, and along with Colonel Norman Allen, we represent the government in this case. Appellant has failed to prove his claims of preemption, multiplicity, and unreasonable multiplication of charges, and thus is entitled to no relief under the first issue. Furthermore, under the second granted issue, the military judge rightly denied appellant's request for a forensic expert. The appellant subsequently received the adequate substitute of Dr. Norris, and appellant suffered no prejudice.
Why was it necessary to have Dr. Norris but not necessary to have Dr. Kennedy?
Your Honor, defense never proved under United States v. Gonzalez why it was necessary for them to have Dr. Kennedy, who was the forensic expert.
Right, but are you saying Dr. Norris wasn't necessary either, and it was just based on the government's good grace that they ended up with an expert at all?
Yes, Your Honor. Dr. Norris was given to the defense.
Just as a bonus gift, they handed out experts at the door that day?
Regardless of the reason why the government decided to give Dr. Norris to the defense, once Dr. Norris was requested by the defense, then he was an adequate substitute.
Now, I understand that piece of the argument. I'm just trying to figure out, this looks like it was all just about money. That if Dr. Kennedy had lived in California rather than in Hawaii, Dr. Kennedy would have been selected by the government. Do we know why Dr. Norris was selected by the government rather than Dr. Kennedy?
Well, Your Honor, Dr. Kennedy, as a forensic, Dr. Kennedy had not, or the defense had not established why it was necessary to have a forensic. Dr. Norris was able to testify and to help the defense.
No, I understand that, but the government thought Dr. Norris was necessary and Kennedy wasn't, and I'm just trying to get at what motivated the government. other than money, because money appears to be the only variable here.
Your Honor, at this point, we can only speculate as to why the government decided to give Dr. Norris to the defense.
The answer is you really don't know. I'm not.
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm making sure.
Yes, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record.
It's not clear to me.
There's nothing in the record except the SJA's motion to, or excuse me, the SJA's recommendation to the convening authority that says they're giving Dr. Norris to the defense, although defense hasn't proved necessity. The military judge did rightly deny their defense for a forensic, since they never established the three-pronged test in United States v. Gonzalez. Once they received Dr. Norris, defense never objected. They never questioned his qualifications. They accepted him not only as an assistant, but they also put him on the stand to testify. Defense had stated in their original request for an expert that the reasons they wanted an expert were first to make a professional and clinical diagnosis of any mental conditions suffered by the appellant, and second, to determine whether the appellant possessed the required intent to commit the crimes. And this is at Joint Appendix 434. Dr. Norris was able to do both of those things. In Dr. Norris's proffer, which is at Joint Appendix 539 and 540, he mentioned that he was comfortable testifying to specific intent and that he had an opinion as to appellant's specific intent. The military judge on motions said that it didn't take a forensic to testify to the issue of specific intent, and that Dr. Norris could testify if the foundation was laid by the defense. Therefore, there was no need for a forensic here because Dr. Norris could meet exactly the intent the defense originally wanted an expert for.
But the government then started whacking at him.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
The government then started attacking his qualifications.
Your Honor, the government's cross-examination is they're allowed to do that. Under United States v. Williams, the Court of Military Appeals stands for the proposition that an expert can be cross-examined, can be thoroughly cross-examined in the same way as any other witness.
How do you answer the appellant's contention that the government has somehow stopped having produced this guy and in some respect, vouched for him as adequate, you then turn around and take a whack at him?
Your Honor, this issue came up in motions prior to the trial, and the military judge ruled that the government does not adopt the expert merely by appointing for the defense. The government also mentioned
he's not the government's expert. Of course he doesn't adopt the expert.
Yes, Your Honor. And if the government believes he's straying from the bounds of his expertise, then they are allowed to pull him back. Furthermore, the defense never objected during this cross-examination. We believe the defense counsel is presumed to be competent. Because they didn't object at the trial, then they forfeited the issue absent plain error.
Well, and did they appeal the military judge's ruling that they could attack the qualifications of the defense expert?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Was the military judge's ruling that they could not attack, that they could attack the defense expert's qualification? Did they appeal that ruling?
No, Your Honor. No. And during the cross-examination, they didn't object either. So because we reviewed under a plain error test, then we can move right to the prejudice problem. And here, there was no prejudice. The appellant got extensive testimony before the panel on all of appellant's mental conditions and his symptoms. Defense was able to present testimony not only through Dr. Norris, but also through appellant's treating physician, Dr. Hicks. Dr. Norris testified to a list of mental disorders and symptoms that the appellant had and how that affected his decision-making process. Similarly, with Dr. Hicks, who testified as to appellant's Asperger's syndrome and how it affected his cognitive functioning. The panel was inundated with over 100 pages of extensive testimony on this issue, so the appellant was fully able to present this information in front of the panel. Furthermore, the government offered no evidence to contradict Dr. Norris's diagnosis. Dr. Malone, on the stand, agreed that the diagnosis of Dr. Norris was a reasonable one. In effect, defense did get some use out of a forensic expert through their cross-examination with Dr. Malone.
Did Dr. Malone agree with the conclusions with respect to both of the defense experts as to the implications for the issues in this case?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Did the prosecution witness agree with the conclusions that the defense witnesses drew with respect to the issues in this case?
What Dr. Malone agreed with, Your Honor, was that the diagnosis of both Dr. Norris and Dr. Hicks.
And what did he disagree with?
He disagreed with Dr. Hicks on the cognitive functioning aspect of Asperger's syndrome, but he didn't disagree with Dr. Norris on Dr. Norris's diagnosis.
And is that significant in this case or not?
It's not significant in this
case.
Why
is that?
Because this case, appellant has centered around the fact Dr. Norris was not an adequate substitute, and Dr. Norris was attacked by the government. So based on that argument, Dr. Hicks' testimony isn't really in play here. Furthermore, in defense's closing argument, they actually used the testimony of Dr. Malone three times to emphasize their point that appellant's mental conditions and his symptoms were reasonable.
What's the implication of Article 46 for this case?
Your Honor,
that aspect of Article 46, which states that the trial counsel, the defense counsel, and the court marshal shall have equal opportunity to obtain witnesses and other evidence in accordance with the rules the president may prescribe. Now, if the prosecution represents to the court that a forensic psychiatrist is not necessary, and then the prosecution obtains a forensic psychiatrist as its witness, what are the implications for Article 46?
Well, Your Honor, here in this specific case, because appellant made clear the reasons he wanted a forensic expert, and because an expert, not a forensic, but a clinical psychologist, was able to testify as to those very issues, then the bottom line for Article 46 is that they received an adequate substitute. They received someone who could testify on the very issues that they wanted an expert for.
I understand the argument that you were making previously as to the issue of prejudice. That is, the question is whether the attack on Hicks is relevant to this case because Hicks wasn't part of that dynamic. That's one of your arguments. But the prosecution did attack Norris and his lack of qualifications compared to the prosecution's witness. Putting aside the issue of prejudice, why isn't that error at that point? Article 46 says the parties are supposed to have equal opportunity to obtain witnesses. The government says you don't need a forensic psychiatrist in this case. The government then produces a forensic psychiatrist for itself and turns around and attacks the defense because the defense witness is not a forensic psychiatrist. Why isn't that error?
Your Honor, the cross-examination of Dr. Norris was brief, first of all, and second of all,
that's a prejudice argument. Why isn't it error to deny the defense the level of qualification of witness that the prosecution has chosen for itself after the prosecution says you don't need that person in this case?
Defense never reopened that door, Your Honor. The military judge allowed defense
That's a waiver issue. Why isn't it error?
Your Honor, under the error doctrine, we also do look to prejudice. So we go back to our prejudice argument that in this case, there was no prejudice since Dr. Malone did not contradict anything that Dr. Norris said.
Would you address the question that I had, and I'll flip it around a different way. Why is Article 104, doesn't it preempt the charge defense under Article 134 in this case?
Your Honor, as we look to the two-pronged test in the United States v. McGinnis, then under the first prong, there's no legislative history that shows that Congress intended to limit prosecution of...
There's no legislative history that suggests that larceny was intended to only be charged under a larceny offense, but I don't think that anyone would think that you could charge it under Article 134 and take away the element of intent to permanently deprive. Do you think so?
Yes, Your Honor. Here,
just to be clear, you think that someone could do that or that they couldn't do that?
Could not do that, Your Honor. But
so
here,
why is this different?
Article 134 has been used in the past for operational security issues such as this one, where the soldier gives information away to someone who's not authorized to have it, including other military members. U.S. v. Attardi stands for that situation where Article 134 was charged and
It was charged in this case, is that what we're looking at here, or are we looking at something that's exactly the same behavior that's charged under the Article 104 offense?
Your Honor, while it may be the same act, the behavior is different. The gravamen of the two offenses is different. On the one hand, under Article 104, you're talking about aiding the enemy, whereas on the other side, for the charge 3, offense. It's focused on a more operational security standpoint within the armed forces.
But it was charged as giving it to a service member, believing that service member to be the enemy. And so if we have Article 104, which prohibits giving military information to the enemy or attempting to give military information to the enemy, why is not Charge 3 an attempt of 104?
Your Honor, Charge 3 is aimed at a different set of facts, whereas Article 104 is aimed at
Which facts are different here?
It's the same act, Your Honor. But the facts that are different are that in one case, the appellant is giving information or attempting to give information to the enemy. And on the other
In both cases, he's attempting to give information to the enemy.
In both cases, he's giving information to U.S. military personnel whom he believed to be members of Al-Qaeda.
And if Article 104 is a congressional statement to address the issue of providing or attempting to provide information to the enemy, and since this particular charge, Charge 3, included that language that they believed him to be the enemy, why does not that become preempted by a statute that specifically addresses that crime?
Again, Your Honor, we believe that the difference in the two is the gravamen of the offense, what he did. And one is aiding the enemy, and the other is from an operational security standpoint, saying that he wrongfully gave information that he was not authorized to give to other military personnel. So while it is the same act, the gravamen of the two offenses are different.
Is it an elements test?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
Is it an elements test?
No, Your Honor, not for preemption.
Not for preemption?
Not for
okay.
preemption.
But the gravamen is different.
Exactly, Your Honor. But
Ultimately go back to? Legislative intent?
Legislative intent, Your Honor, and also whether the offense charged is composed of a residuum of elements from a specific offense and asserted to be a violation of Article 134.
Why don't you run it through with a false flag operation? Do you know what a false flag operation is?
No, Your Honor.
Let's say that the person is posing as an Al-Qaeda person, but really they represent a different foreign government, whether they're a New York Times reporter or a reporter. Tell me which crimes have been committed in that context.
It would be similar to this case, Your Honor, where on the one side he was attempting to aid the enemy, and on the other side he was giving information to someone outside of, or someone that he did not have authorization to give that information to, similar to this Article 134 offense.
How is it different or like that in this context we're not dealing with a foreign false flag or a reporter, but U.S. government officials who have put themselves into the flow of traffic? It's a flat question. I'm asking you compare and contrast.
The difference between the news reporter, Your Honor, and the military personnel? Well, either way, whether it is the news reporter or the military personnel, if the individual who gives them the information does not have the authority to disseminate that information, then the charge under Article 134 would be the same.
So the dishonorable act is not the intent of who you think is you're giving it to, but rather the dishonor of giving it to random people?
That you don't have the authorization to give that information up to, Your Honor.
I understand.
Is that the best argument that you have with respect to why there's no preemption in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. If there are any, are there any further questions on any of the other issues under the granted issue one?
If we hold that it's preempted, what's the consequence?
Your Honor, if this court were to find that that charge is preempted, then this case should go back to the Army Corps for sentence reassessment.
Why? Why is there prejudice on sentencing?
Because, Your Honor, that would effectively, it could effectively take one of the charges off of his convictions. So because of that, sentence reassessment would most likely be
Counsel, you may conclude.
The charges fairly and accurately represent appellant's criminal culpability. Moreover, the military judge rightly denied appellant's request for a forensic expert. Dr. Morris served as an adequate substitute, and appellant suffered no prejudice. Appellant received a fair trial, and he is entitled to no relief. Therefore, the government respectfully requests that this honorable court affirm the findings in the sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
I have a question. Why is this not like a false flag operation?
I'm not sure I understood your hypothetical, Judge Baker.
Let's say the facts are the exact same. He thinks he's giving it to Al-Qaeda representatives. In fact, he gives it to Foreign Intelligence Service X. Because
the Russians in Lone Tree.
I don't want to name just any government. The Foreign Intelligence Service of Antarctica. And they know this guy's an Al-Qaeda sympathizer, and they're sucker punching.
They dress like penguins, I believe.
Yeah, that's what I... But they know this guy's a sucker for Al-Qaeda. And so, as a standard practice in the field, they go to him and they say, we're from Al-Qaeda and we're here to help you, help us. He gives them the information, understanding that they're Al-Qaeda, but in fact, they're not. They're a foreign intelligence service. Why isn't that a 134 offense, in addition to being an attempt to aid the enemy? Is it not discrediting, in a general intent context, to give intelligence to the Foreign Intelligence Service of Antarctica, even if you did not know you were doing it?
I don't see why the addition of another step in the chain, you know, suppose you give it to the penguins and then you give it to the polar bears and then you could have like a relay race of false fronts. I don't see what difference that would make. I think that actually...
You still have preemption, you would argue.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if he thinks he's in all good faith giving it to a member of Congress, but in fact it's Al-Qaeda, he has not communicated with the enemy because it's a specific intent offense.
That the member of Congress...
Let's put Congress out of it.
Yeah,
so you're saying still preemptive, and so it makes no difference whether he ends up giving it to government agents, foreign intelligence agents, journalists. He's only guilty of one offense if he's handing it out thinking it's Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
That's your argument, okay.
Yes. Yes.
Counsel, turning to the other issue, assuming that error arose when the government did not provide a forensic psychiatrist at the time that it relied on a forensic psychiatrist, the government has identified two concerns with respect to the defense position. One is waiver, and the second is that the government's position is that the only substantive testimony that was of help to the accused, that in terms of a difference between the government and the defense at trial, came from Hicks, and that Hicks was not the expert who was the subject of this particular dispute. So could you address each one of those prejudice arguments?
So on the waiver point, we don't have a right to interlocutory appeal. It's not, you know, we don't have the Article 62 opportunity.
The defense had the opportunity at trial, as the government suggested, to say, Your Honor, we're in a different position than we were at the time the motions were litigated. Right. Now the expert has the qualifications that we wanted. We object to this cross-examination. Why isn't there waiver and failure to make that objection?
By failing to make the objection, our view on this is that we have done the right thing because to have made the objection, I think, would have been futile in the circumstances.
Aren't you bringing a different circumstance to the attention of the judge? That is, the judge made the original decision based upon her conclusion that a clinical psychologist adequately met the needs of the defense. Now, isn't the defense obligated to bring to the judge's attention that from the defense perspective, circumstances have changed?
Well, I don't think the defense had a duty to continue to be harping on the same thing. The defense's position had been clear from the beginning. I think it would be like repeating an objection time and time again.
Okay, your time is about to expire. What about Hicks? Hicks was not the expert who was substituted by the government. Hicks is an expert who was called by the defense because of Hicks's particular examination of the accused in this instance. What, if any, prejudice flows from the judge's decisions in terms of the dispute between the government and the defense as to the significance of Hicks's testimony when the government attacks Hicks' qualifications?
The answer is that Hicks, let me back up. The government throughout had the advantage of a forensic psychiatrist, a person with particularized training and experience in the presentation of expert testimony.
Did the government at any point relate the absence of forensic psychiatric qualifications to a problem with Hicks's testimony?
No, I don't recall that they did, Your Honor. It's a fair question. I don't recall that they did. The one point that counsel made in response to a question from the bench a minute ago was what remedy with respect to the first granted issue. Now, obviously, if we're right on the second granted issue, that entails a rehearing. So that will subsume relief on the first granted issue. On the other hand, the court still has to address the first granted issue. Otherwise, we'll be right back here, God forbid, assuming there's a conviction, several years from now. So you do have to address the first question. But on the assumption that the only issue on which any relief is granted is the first issue, then I will say I respectfully disagree with counsel that all that is required is a remand for reassessment of the sentence by the Court of Criminal Appeals. I believe that Specialist Anderson ought to get back in front of a jury for basically a new hearing on sentence. I don't believe this is one that lends itself where you have a life sentence. I don't think it's asking too much to send the matter back. I will say that my thinking on this is somewhat colored by what I consider extremely unimpressive work by the Army Court when it did have an opportunity to evaluate this case. I have no further comments unless the Court has some questions.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the Court will be in recess until 10:20 a.m.